On the Record on News Talk,
brought to you by PwC, a community of solvers coming together in unexpected ways. It all adds up to the new equation.
Plenty to get through in today's papers. I'll start my tour of the front pages this morning with the Business Post, because we're told that Ireland is on track to increase its greenhouse gas emissions in 2021, a stark prediction which will heap pressure on the government as it's about to have a radical, a radical measures to halve emissions by 2030. What's going to happen this week is that the government is going to publish 2 5-year carbon budgets. In fact, I understand that they're due to be published tomorrow, and they're going to outline how exactly we're supposed to halve our carbon emissions by the end of this decade. But we are told today in the Business Post that that emissions in 2021 will be larger than in 2020. Now, you might think that's understandable because we spent a lot of 2020 in lockdown, which meant that there was fewer transport emissions, fewer industrial emissions, energy emissions actually went down, but we only reduced them by 3.6% last year, and it looks like we're going to go backwards in 2021, all of which means even more work coming down the line when it comes to trying to meet those targets by the end of the decade. I'll be talking more to David Wallace Wells later in the programme, as I said, about that COP26 summit getting underway a week from today in Glasgow and what exactly is at stake. Also on the front page of the Business Post this morning, Sinn Féin has extended its lead over the government parties since the budget was announced in its strongest ever performance in a Business Post Red Sea poll. The party support is up to 33% of the first preference vote. It's an increase of 4 points since last month. It means that Sinn Féin has now surged ahead of Fine Gael, which is down by 3 points to 25, and Fianna Fáil, which is down by 1 point to 12. The Green Party is down 1 point to 4%. That Sinn Féin lead, that last month their lead was the first time that ever that they have been the most popular party in a Red Sea poll. Now that lead is already swelled to 8 percentage points. The front page of the Sunday Times this morning, pubs furious at mixed messages on tracing rules. Confusion reigns in the hospitality industry this weekend over proposals to require nightclubs, music venues and late bars to issue electronic tickets to their customers so that they can be contact traced in the event of a COVID-19 outbreak. Statements by ministers yesterday appeared to contradict the briefings by government officials on Friday, creating widespread uncertainty even as COVID infections continued to rise. Reported 2,427 new COVID cases yesterday. The numbers in ICU rose 3 to 93, and they could, according to NPHET calculations, exceed 150 in a month. It is worth reflecting, by the way, we are now 59 hours into this new setup where you're allowed to have certain mass gatherings, and you're allowed to have maybe 1,500 people at an indoor standing event, and you're allowed to have a full house at outdoor events. The legal regulations behind all of that, as of this moment, have not yet been published, which means, legally speaking, that because the previous ones lapsed, there is actually nothing now legally enforceable about policing for mass gatherings and anything of the like, which I think is important, because we've had examples highlighted in the last couple of weeks about how events which might have been against guidelines were apparently in keeping with the legal regulations. So it is an important distinction. Haven't been published yet, and that those new rules kicked into effect at a minute past midnight on Friday morning. Also on the front page of the Sunday Times, on a totally separate note, Facebook has hit back at claims by the businessman Dennis O'Brien that it has an amoral business model, that it doesn't invest in broadband in Africa, and that Ireland has become its laundrette for the biggest tax avoidance scheme in the world. Speaking at the Brian Lenihan Memorial Lecture at Cambridge University last week, O'Brien said that Ireland's partnership with Facebook was regrettable due to what he called the social media platform's egregious practices. He says that Facebook generates the equivalent of $1 a month from each of its users in Africa by raising billions of dollars in advertising revenue across the continent, but gives little back. Facebook yesterday issued a statement to the Sunday Times completely dismissing a lot of those claims. The front page of the Irish Mail on Sunday this morning, speed up booster rollout to stop jab waste. Very interesting story from the Mail on Sunday. People will have heard a lot of debates this week around whether booster shots should be given to frontline healthcare workers in the case to stop them both contracting, but also perhaps to stop them spreading COVID-19 over the course of the winter months. What we learned today from the Mail on Sunday is that, in fact, there are large shipments of vaccines which will shortly go out of use because of the expiry dates that's on them. And really, there is something of a race against time where the HSE would quite like the ability to issue some of those jabs to its healthcare workers to save them having to be disposed of in only a couple of weeks' time. And finally for now, which I've deliberately left until last, the front page of the Sunday Independent. First of all, we're told that power cuts in family homes cannot be ruled out over the winter due to significant supply issues facing the energy sector. The paper has seen a confidential briefing note for a cabinet committee on climate change, where ministers were told that energy suppliers could be forced to introduce emergency measures to cope with high demand for electricity during the colder months. Under worst-case scenario contingency plans, businesses could be given as little as an hour's notice to reduce their electricity use or to switch to generators, while family homes will also be discontinued from the network. The briefing document says every measure will be taken to avoid cutting off power, which is a very sunny outlook. But also on the front page of the Sunday Independent, I think we'll start with this morning. The nation braces for another COVID wave as infighting and errors are revealed. Now is the time to hold our nerve, said a senior government source this weekend, as the country braces for COVID-19 infection rates to hit levels not seen since the life and death crisis last January. As concern grows that COVID races will soar again, threatening the health system this winter, a book to be published this week reveals significant missteps and serious interpersonal relationship fault lines in the management of the crisis to date. The book also discloses the firm belief of the Chief Medical Officer, Tony Houlihan, that the government's failure to follow NPHET advice this time last year, and people all remember that row, meant the country lost control of the virus in the run-up to Christmas, leading to 100,000 hospitalizations and 1,420 deaths in January. It's an extract from the book A State of Emergency, the story of Ireland's COVID crisis, written by Richard Chambers, who, of course, full disclosure, is a colleague and friend of mine at Virgin Media News. We are joined in studio by Fergus Finlay, who's a member of the board of the HSC, and also by Aoife Barry, who's assistant editor, assistant news editor at thejournal.ie. Thank you both for coming in this morning. Aoife, I might, if I may, allow you to run us through some of the various disclosures that are in the extract published today by the Sunday Independent of Richard's book, because the extract that we see focuses on the activities of October 2020, when there was that row about going to level 5. And there's an awful lot to get through.
Yeah, two full pages of it, and it's very juicy. It's really interesting to go back and look at a year ago and everything kind of breaking down, as Richard Chambers does in this extract, everything that happened, and particularly the fact that he talks to people on both kind of sides, so the government side and then the NPHET side and HSE as well. So you do get the attitudes that people had, and he runs through, you know, Holohan's return to NPHET and the fact that he was really pushing for that level 4, level 5 recommendation, which became a level 5 recommendation in October, and how this was leaked and then was seen really by government ministers at the time as what he calls in the book a bounce, in inverted commas, so that they were basically being forced to make a decision by NPHET and by this information leaking. And we know there's been a lot of talk about who's leaky or who's not in cabinet over the last little while. But one bit that really stood out to me in it that I thought was particularly interesting, that showed the reaction or the thoughts of some people in government, was, so if people remember the tarnished earlier of Radcliffe appeared on Clareburn Live, and he hit out at NPHET and at their recommendation to go to a level 5, which the government decided to go against at the time, which we can kind of probably go into later. He was quite frustrated, it says here, tired, ready to let his feelings be known. He said that the NPHET recommendation came out of the blue. He said this on live TV, that it hadn't been thought through, there hadn't been prior consultation. You know, it's described here as Varadkar having his anger barely concealed. And what I thought was interesting was there's some knowledge here of the reaction of people. So obviously people from NPHET and government were watching this, and it says that the WhatsApp groups were flooded with opinion about what happened. That one minister admitted he balled his fist watching it. Fair play, Leo. Go on, give it socks. I just thought it was interesting to kind of, you know, imagine the reactions, people having these kind of over the top reactions to this thing that actually affected everybody around the country, and that it also was a Rubicon, like it says, they're being crossed at Leofracker actually hitting out at NPHET. It felt like, did that open the floodgates then for more criticism of particularly Tony Holohan, but the activities and the recommendations of NPHET? And we all know what happened in January 2021, so many people would disagree with what his opinion was at the time.
What's fascinating, I think, about this whole spread, which is all across pages 12 and 13 today of the Sunday Independent, is that it reveals not alone a lot of the factionalism, so politicians versus NPHET, NPHET versus HSE, but also some of the splits that there were within that. And it's also quite revealing because there are some ministers whose reactions you never would have really seen otherwise, really being vented into the public arena. So, for example, Pascal Donoghue, who is not somebody that you'd usually associate with having very public expressions of anger or frustration one way or another. He apparently was at this cabinet subcommittee on the Monday night after NPHET's recommendation arrived on the Sunday. He let them have it, says the book. "We can't go on like this," he said, looking down the table at them. "We cannot go on like this." He was appreciative of the human cost, but he was also concerned about the bottom line, and everyone else around that table sensed that they really understood that Pascal Donoghue was struggling about the financial aspects to all of this. Also quite significant, I think, the fact that the HSE chief executive, Paul Reid, was shocked and surprised, because if NPHET was acting to try and prevent the health healthcare sector from being overwhelmed, Paul Reid didn't seem to think that it was actually all that necessary at the time.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see the reaction of NPHET. So when Paul Reid was describing her presenting information to Cabinet in a meeting and NPHET were there, they kind of felt like Paul Reid was going with the government side and going against them, whereas I think they would have presumed that, you know, he would have been more on their side in terms of kind of protecting people across the country or whatever. But I thought that was interesting because it shows, like you're saying, those kind of inter-fights between people. I mean, there's also Colm Henry, who apparently gave Tony Holden a phone call, told him that he'd blown it, and apparently that has had some sort of an impact on their relationship, according to the book. So there are those tensions within NPHET itself, which really goes to show what was going on behind the scenes, all these big decisions being
made. One point of note on that, actually, and maybe you might have a better experience of the broadband situation in West Cork. Colm Henry was down in Skull, in his own native part of the world, for that weekend, and actually wasn't able to fully participate in the NPHET video call on the Sunday because his connection was so in and out that he actually wasn't able to contribute. I don't know whether that's typical with broadband experiences around General West Cork. You might know better than I do.
I'd say it would be all right. Not okay. Your broadband plan not kicking in there, but definitely.
What I think is quite significant about that is that if you understand the makeup of NPHET, Colm Henry is basically sort of almost like the HSE de facto representative. So you could argue that he's almost there as the emissary. He's there as the representative of the HSE. And maybe had he been able to contribute more saliently on the Sunday, if his broadband was better or if he was somewhere else and he was able to chip into that meeting and say, I don't think the situation is as grave as you might perceive it.
Yeah.
Maybe things might have been very different.
Yeah, because it depends on whose voices are heard around the table and how loudly they're heard. And if you physically can't be heard because of the infrastructural issues in the area where you are to broadband, then it does raise the question of like who's being heard, who's being listened to and what small little things kind of happened that could have led into bigger decisions. But it's so interesting, I think, to get to delve in deep to see all those small parts and how they all came together and how they all added up to the situation that we're in a year later.
Fergus Finlay, you are familiar with the structures of power inside government buildings. Once upon a time, you were a chef de cabinet for the Labour Party and coalition there. More recently, you're a member of the board of the HSC. So before I sort of pick your brain for personal analyses, anything across these two pages that jumps out at you as being extraordinary or surprising?
Well, nothing surprising, no. I think everybody would have known about the row that happened at the time. And there is
well,
no
if they
doubt,
didn't know, Leo Varadkar made it fairly clear on Clare Byrne that Monday night, didn't he?
You could hardly avoid it after that outburst. It happened, first of all, it did happen out of the blue. The Sunday night meeting was an emergency meeting. Mm-hmm. It sprang from Chief Medical Officer's concerns that the figures were much worse and heading much worse than maybe others believed. I think with the benefit of hindsight, most people would now accept that he was right. But the way in which it was all communicated and done was just a terrible mess. It was just an awful mess. You can't, particularly in a situation like that, which is really grave. I mean, if you're moving to level 5, that has enormous implications for everyone who lives in the country, but it also has enormous implications for public administration, for health service management. You've got to, you know, be able to change things around very quickly. Things like the PUP, all of that has to be planned and organised. And therefore, it is, I think, absurd to think that you can do that overnight without telling the Taoiseach.
Well,
and that's what happened on this occasion. Well, then the Taoiseach basically was completely blindsided.
The question arises then for all of that as to whether it is NPHET's responsibility or if it's NPHET's purview to think out all of that, because NPHET is a public health emergency team. And yes, there are plenty of other consequences like PUP, like how exactly you're going to run the country, how exactly the country is actually to be administered if everyone is remote again or once again staying at home. But it's not up to NPHET to decide that. NPHET assesses the situation, says, this is grave, we recommend a lockdown.
These are our recommendations.
And they pass that on to government, which then decides what to do. So I don't understand why people were expecting NPHET to game out what you do with the PUP, for example.
No, they weren't. They weren't expecting that. What they were expecting was to be more in the loop around the process, not to have a letter appearing 20 minutes after it was published in the media. I mean, most ministers read about NPHET's advice on the 9 o'clock news that night, on the Sunday night. It was out and leaked, and that was the big disaster in a way, that that people were caught completely blindsided. Every minister in every government, irrespective of their party affiliation, has decisions that they have to make in the face of advice like that, And therefore, they have to be clued in. They have to be involved.
So does the leaking of that then cloud their judgment?
It didn't cloud their judgment. It blindsided them completely, absolutely completely. And particularly, I think it blindsided the Taoiseach. And it made others the Taoiseach was clearly enraged by it.
Yeah.
And that's why he launched the attack he launched. Mm. I mean, I think the important thing to say, though, is that in my sense anyway, my observation, lessons have been learned from it. Their relationship is a much better relationship now. Mm. It is a much more even-handed relationship. There are senior civil servants like Martin Fraser, for example, who are now much more in the loop, much more clued in. The process is much more
inclusive. I really think almost in the immediate wake of this, they then reconfigured the civil service process so that even 2 weeks later, when another recommendation came in, it was sent to a committee led by Martin Fraser so that they could sanitise it almost.
Well, not sanitise it, but begin the process of implementation. And I mean, the reality is NPHET makes advice, government makes decisions. But the government decision-making process has to be quick. It has to be, sure. It has to be certain. The decisions that were made then were the wrong decisions.
Well,
and part of the reason is the process that was indulged in, I would say.
Let's go back one step then, because you mentioned how one of the major mistakes in all of this was that the government, or particularly the Taoiseach, was not kept in the loop. And this is a question which is addressed in an early part of this excerpt, because there were some people advising Tony Holohan, and I'm quoting here, to skip past the health minister and ring the alarm directly with Taoiseach Micheál Martin. Holohan, however, was adamant that he would stick to the chain of command. That's the bleeping minister's job, is the quote. What was the feeling among some of those who told him to bypass Stephen Donnelly and go straight to the Taoiseach? Never send a boy on a man's errand. So at one point there you have Tony Holohan saying, well, the chain of command is that I am ultimately a civil servant in the Department of Health. I have to report to my own minister first. On the other
and
hand,
isn't
you
that
have,
right?
And
isn't
on the
that
other,
correct?
On the other hand, you have the pragmatism of what you are proposing is so serious that maybe you need to brief the Taoiseach as early as possible.
And yet there are people all over the system who say Tony Holohan has lost the run of himself. Tony Holohan thinks he's a part of the land. Tony Holohan thinks he's God. I mean, all those quotes are in that abstract.
Yeah.
How much more likely would it be that they would be saying that kind of thing about the chief medical officer if he decided that only the Taoiseach or the president was worthy of his attention? A civil servant has to go through the relevant and appropriate minister. I suspect, if you use phrases like never send a boy on a man's errand, all that's designed to do is disparage the Minister for Health. It's not there for any other purpose.
I should say that is not a quote which is attributed to Tony Holohan. It's a quote attributed to some of the people advising Holohan to bypass Stephen Donnelly and go straight to the Taoiseach. I really should stress that it's not attributed to Tony Holohan.
I think it would have been appropriate for Tony Holohan to say to the Minister at the time, and I don't know whether it was done or not, look, this is really serious. You need to get the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach into the loop as quickly as possible.
Mm. Yeah.
The indications from the extract are that it was all a bit vague.
One thing which is also striking, Aoife, in the course of this very extensive extract is that people might presume that this was a case of Tony Holohan coming back because we knew that he'd been on compassionate leave for a few months attending to his wife, and then was to later pass away. And that people presumed Tony had a much more pessimistic view of things than Ronan Glynn did.
Mm-hmm.
Tony comes back in the saddle, decides we need to shut the thing down, and it's all done on his sort of personal whim. Mm-hmm. There's an extract that says that Ronan Glynn says that he understands that perception, but he believes that even if Holohan had stayed on leave an extra week or two, NPHET would not have got much further through the week without having to make very significant recommendations, and asked whether it was handled the right way. His answer is curt. I believe the advice was the correct advice. Thereby decoupling Tony Holohan as a person from the advice that was ultimately to be handed over. This was a deteriorating situation.
Yeah, and obviously he's backing up Paul in there, who he works very closely with. But I think it does show that there's so many opinions around who's making what decisions and who's got what power. And it kind of highlights the constant power plays and power struggles that go on within government and go on within, I suppose, maybe the civil service in general, although like we were talking about there is a hierarchy there that people have to stick with. But what I find interesting overall looking at this idea that people in government somehow felt that NPHET were trying to push against them, to usurp them, to show off that they had more power, when like you were saying earlier, what they're trying to do is make decisions based on their knowledge of their certain areas around public health in the country.
I think there were two things happening. I think that's definitely one of them. I think the other thing that was happening at the time was that ministers were under immense pressure about Christmas approaching.
Mm.
We'd been in lockdown.
Huge public pressure.
Yeah, we'd been in lockdown. And you remember Micheál Martin's phrase about having a meaningful Christmas and so on. There was huge pressure As you know, as we've seen in the last couple of weeks around pubs and nightclubs and so on, there was huge pressure on government to open up, enormous pressure.
And that,
so any advice from Leffert that was cautious was going to be not welcome.
We'll talk about nightclubs and everything else in just a minute, and I have to get to a break. But just before I do that, and I don't know whether, Fergus, you want to answer this question with your HSE director's hat on or with your independent hat on, with your Irish Examiner columnist hat on. So maybe you might preface your answer however you like. If you accept the general structure that Colm Henry is supposed to be on NPHET as something of a HSE representative or an emissary, and you have a situation where NPHET is meeting on a Sunday afternoon and it makes a fairly grave recommendation that the country should be placed into a full lockdown forthwith, and that decision is made without Colm Henry or anyone else from the HSE being able to contribute, should there in fact have been a pause put on things to assess with the HSE whether this was necessary? Because if the design of NPHET is that there is a HSE voice in the room, and that voice was silent on this occasion, especially with the consequent fallout between Colm Henry and Tony Houlihan, the tensions that there's always been between the HSE and NPHET, ought they not have just to put the pause on things just to make sure that the HSE were actually on board with this recommendation?
Well, you can answer that with any hat on you like. I think, first of all, I have to say, Colm Henry is not on NPHET as an emissary of the HSE. He's a full senior member of NPHET.
Okay.
And his advice is independent as a public health doctor and as the lead public health doctor.
So he's not there to represent the HSE.
He's not there as a clinician. Sometimes he represents NPHET to the HSE. Sometimes he represents HSE to NPHET. His part of his expertise and part of his advice is to say to NPHET, this is what's possible. This is what we can do. This is how quickly we can react to
the HSE. Should there then maybe be an explicit HSE emissary on NPHET who represents that view? Because one suspects that the cabinet might have looked at things
when it's appropriate to do that.
Because one expects the cabinet might have looked at things a little bit more differently if Paul Reid hadn't gone in and said, we're coping, a lockdown is unnecessary.
And we were coping. I mean, there's never been a moment when I've been on since the pandemic started. I think I can say this quite openly. There's never been a moment when I've been on the HSE board when we haven't been sort of ready for the next emergency or thinking, worrying about the next emergency, planning for the next emergency. And at the same time, trying to maintain that balance between, what you can do, what people need, from the HSE. I mean, like, we've found ourselves over the last whatever period the pandemic has lasted having to say no to people about all sorts of stuff as a HSE, as a health system, about, you know, hip operations and all sorts of things that people need because of COVID. We found ourselves in that position constantly. And that's a constant pressure on the HSE. The health system exists to provide decent health care in whatever way it's needed. And COVID has been an enormous drain on that. But that's not to say, whatever needs to be done will be done. And I mean, one of the things I'm proudest of, both as a member of the board of the HSE and as a citizen, is the fact that despite mistakes, and we can all talk about mistakes, the HSE has managed the COVID pandemic brilliantly well. It has saved lives that wouldn't otherwise have been saved. It has coped in ways that nobody would have thought possible. I've said here before that the HSE was probably the worst entity in the whole world to have to cope with the pandemic because of the way it had been starved of resources for years and years. And yet it rose to that challenge.
Far be it for me, I should say, to speak on behalf of Richard, but I dare say that maybe a lot of the contributions or the comments in the book were made with a certain level of candour, maybe on the presumption or the belief that NPHET wouldn't still be around, or indeed that we'd be long out of any emergency response to COVID by the time these were published, so that there would all be a sense of water under the bridge. I would be interested to see exactly how the dynamics, if there are still anything that's worth scope for change between all of these personalities, might change now with all of this background knowledge somewhat in the open. It'll be fascinating to see how all of this
things
change.
I think when we get to read the whole book, we'll hear about other rows as well. I'm sure there were many other rows. I think there was a struggle in the first few months of the pandemic to arrive at a point, politicians, HSE, NPHET, public policy, to arrive at a point of mutual respect and mutual collaboration and working. I think throughout the early stages of the pandemic, nobody was quite clear in Ireland who the boss was.
Which is worth reflecting on as well, because it was a caretaker government. And the point is, again, made in this extract that maybe NPHET was a comfortable entity to fill the power void because no one felt like the government was legitimate.
Also essential. I mean, you know, where would we be now if we didn't have Leffen? We might hate them, we might disparage them, we might think, you know, their ideas about their station, but where the hell would we be without them?
I could just can't confirm from the bits of the book that I have had the privilege of reading before it gets published this coming Thursday. There are plenty of other fights between plenty of other people,
sure,
all of which are reported in brilliant detail in the book, which is coming out on Thursday. We're still going through this morning's Sunday papers with Fergus Finlay and Aoife Barry. And of course, aside from there being a lot written about October 2020 and COVID management, there is understandably an awful lot written on October 2021 and COVID management, because it is only this week just gone that the government did decide, based on Neffert's advice, to proceed, albeit more slowly, with the gradual reopening of society. There's a lot written about that in today's papers, about the role of antigen tests, about children being encouraged to take part in rapid COVID screening, about the situation regarding the health system and how well it is prepared to cope with what might be coming. There's also a little bit written about Delta Plus, which is another semi-strain of the Delta variant, AY.4.2, if you're into the technical stuff. 75 cases of it sequenced in Ireland so far, but perhaps maybe more out there in the wild. Aoife, there's so much written in today's papers. Where do you want to start? Does anything jump out for you today?
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting. I mean, the Sunday Times have a story that a couple of other places have, but I think it's a real talking point at the moment about pubs being furious at what they call the mixed messaging on tracing rules. So, and just generally kind of looking at the reaction of the live music and nightclub sectors to the announcement on Friday, and the fact that like you had this long drawn out, it really wasn't Friday, we're talking actually Tuesday, it was a long kind of drawn out discussion about what's going to happen with nightclubs, and that people on Tuesday in the nightclub sector who've been waiting like 19 months to reopen were left not knowing exactly what was going to happen in 3 days' time. And then they had the kind of protracted talks with government, and then they were not happy with the resulting regulations once they were announced, because they were slightly different to what they had thought were being agreed. And it's just another example of how things can constantly become this kind of battle between how much information people are given, how kind of prepared government is when it gives its announcements. It's like, you know, it's press conferences or when the teacher comes out and announces what's happening, regulations, and how people can feel kind of left behind and like they've been, you know, forgotten about or treated badly. I mean, I think, you know, when it comes to the nightclub situation, if the government had come out on Tuesday when they were doing the press conference to say what was going to happen with the 22nd of October regulations, if they had come out and said, We are treating the nightclub sector with its own sectoral guidelines, and they'll be available within the next day or two, and we're taking, you know, a moment to talk about it, and we're trying to make our decisions about it, and we have to, you know, spend our time on it, there might not have been the reaction that there was, because people, I think, felt that they were like, oh yeah, sectoral guidelines, people will be shifting in the nightclub anyway, we'll sort it all out. And it kind of felt like there wasn't
11:34 if you had the sweepstake open about shifting in nightclubs, by the way, if you want, anyone wants to put a bet on how quickly that would come up.
Exactly, who knew it would be a big talk about. I think they could have just avoided that assumption that they didn't care about the nightclub sector by being more open about it takes time for us to get these regulations together and make these decisions, and also not coming out with an agreement on the Friday at like, what was it, 7 p.m. or something, that people were like, we didn't know this was going to be in it, which was the ticketing aspect, ticketing people to buying tickets in advance to get into nightclubs.
We had a situation on my TV hat on in Virgin Media News where Paul Quinn was in a city centre nightclub in Dublin on the bulletin at 5:30 talking about the arrangements that everyone presumed were going to be in place, and then between his bulletin at 5:30 and his bulletin at 8:00 there was a dramatic change where suddenly now there was a bit more clarity on whether you had to consume your drink at the bar or at the table or somewhere else, or where would it be, and also about ticketing, and they really felt like they had been thrown under the bus again, which I suppose, Fergus, raises the question about whether it might have been more appropriate to have some discussions with the industry about possible plan B. I mean, bearing in mind it was only Tuesday just gone that they learned they weren't going to be opening fully for All and Sundry, and whether it might have been appropriate in the background to say, if this doesn't work out, let's start fleshing out what the fallback situation is going to be. Or do you still have to wait for the situation to unfold and then act with clarity at the time?
No, I mean, I guess it probably would have been more appropriate if it was possible to dot every I and cross every T. I'm sure that would have been the absolutely desirable thing and leave everybody in a position of complete and absolute certainty, both the providers of these services and the users of these services. But I think it would also have been possible for the nightclub owners and others to come up with ways themselves of guaranteeing the safety of their staff, their premises, their customers. I know they will all say they've done that and they've been, you know, faithful to all that. And, you know, I can only offer you anecdotal evidence. I haven't been in a nightclub yet. In fact, at my esteemed and venerable age, I have never been in a nightclub. But the other day I went into a coffee shop in Bray with my daughter, I'll tell you the name of the coffee shop, but it was Lizanne's on the main street.
Okay.
And before we sat down, they asked me for my COVID pass and they asked me for my ID. And they asked her, she has Down syndrome and was wearing a mask and all that. They asked her for her COVID pass. And then, you know, when we spread all that, they treated us extremely courteously and well. Over the following 3 days, I was in three other coffee shops in Bray, which I won't name. And I wasn't asked for any of that, any of that. I just wandered in. I suspect if I hadn't had
and that
was on,
that wasn't for takeaway. That was to
no,
sit
no,
down.
No, it was just to have a sit down and a chat. And I suspect if I wasn't wearing a mask, they wouldn't even have noticed.
Okay.
So I think it is fair to say that not everyone is as scrupulous as they need to be.
I was making observations earlier on about the regulations and how, you know, we're now nearly 60 hours
into
this.
There are still guidelines.
Well, there are guidelines to industries, sensible. But then there's also legal regulations, which as of yet haven't been produced for this new era. So actually, since Friday, it's very difficult to enforce any kind of restrictions on indoor hospitality or anything of the sort.
But it's not difficult to implement them. It's not difficult to manage them yourself. It's not, well, it's difficult, but it's not impossible to manage them yourself.
Well, let me ask
you. If you're going to rely always on enforcement.
Yeah.
I heard on the radio this morning that there's a highly visible Garda presence around Dublin, which I presume is about antisocial behaviour and so on. It's not about enforcement of regulations if they can't be enforced. But it's not difficult for the owners of premises to insist that these are the standards and these are the standards that we insist on here.
Well, wearing your HSE hat specifically this time, the figures for last night had 459 people confirmed COVID-19 cases in hospitals. It had 93 people in intensive care. There were only 17 vacant intensive care beds across the country. They're very geographically patchy. I think there's only one available bed in is there even any? In fact, I'm just looking at the figures right now. There were none available in Cork last night. Both CUH and Mercy both had completely full ICU units, which means that on the weekend of Cork Jazz Festival, there was literally not a single ICU bed available in the city. It hardly seems like the ideal backdrop against which you would start permitting people to engage in the behaviour which we've been specifically told for 18 months is the riskiest behaviour, getting up close and personal in nightclubs.
Well, it's not the ideal backdrop. And
Then should we be doing it?
If you're asking me personally, citizen Fergus Finlay, member of the board Fergus Finlay, I don't think we should. I think it's too soon and I think it's too risky. And I think there's a thing that is never said about the way we behave in Ireland, and I'm as guilty of this as the next person, so I'm not being sanctimonious. We drink too much on these occasions. We don't go to a nightclub just to dance. We go to a nightclub to get off our heads and dance. And that is the way in which we end up throwing caution to the winds, indoors and outdoors. I stood behind in shop yesterday. I stood behind a chap in the queue who was loading three or four slabs of beer onto the counter, bottles of this and bottles of that. And I actually said to him, "That's some gig you're planning for the weekend." And he said, and he looked at me and he said, "Yeah, confirmation mad, isn't it?" It just occurred to me.
Well, presumes the candidate for confirmation wasn't going to be particularly involved.
The candidate for confirmation wasn't, but everyone coming to the house was going to be blathered by the end of the day, and at least the offer was going to be there. We have an unhealthy relationship with alcohol in Ireland, a deeply unhealthy relationship. We romanticise it in all sorts of ways. Mm. We're the only country in the world where people are routinely told that they're a martyr to the drink. And that's a big problem when it comes to COVID.
In that light then, are you surprised that NPHET gave its blessing to this gradual and cautious loosening of restrictions, given that we have been told by several figures within NPHET that COVID loves alcohol and that they are now allowing COVID perhaps to flourish in an environment where alcohol is going to be pretty plentiful?
I suspect that this is something that was done in hope, something that is done in the hope that this will be better managed than it has been in the past, that publicans and nightclub operators and so on will be a little bit stricter about, standards in their premises.
There is one other observation in all of this, Aoife, not even so much about the why you're allowed to dance in a nightclub and not in a pub, and whether you can dance and stand in at a standing gig and where you can and can't, and all of those anomalies, which the Taoiseach says are almost there by design. Mm. It's the fact that, originally speaking, when we were going to go back to what was tantamount to a Freedom Day on October 22nd, NPHET was advising that on the basis that we would already have peaked cases, that we'd already be on the downswing, that we'd have already been over the worst, and that we would basically be on the road home, and that's why it was okay to then loosen the restrictions. It seems like a fairly dramatic change then to acknowledge that we might not be at the worst of this wave for another 3 or 4 or 5 weeks, that ICUs won't be at their most populated until the end of November, and to decide a month in advance of that that you can allow behaviour which even they themselves say is risky.
Yeah, I suppose there's two things there. I think one thing is that the COVID situation, as we've seen for the last, 19 or so months, is so changeable in the sense that information can come to light that makes NPHET worry, or that makes maybe the government worry, and that decisions have to be made very quickly, and that we do have to get used to the idea of, you know, restrictions, it being announced that restrictions will be loosened and then that being changed at the last minute. I think that's just kind of part of life now, unfortunately, and we do have to deal with the fact that we're not always going to maybe be happy with the amount of time or the length of time we're given to get used to things, and that things will be pulled back, they'll be taken away and they'll be given again. But within that context, there's a lot of balancing to go on. I suppose there's kind of economic balance, and then there's like sectoral balancing in terms of there are people who work in the nightclub industry or the live music or live events industry who haven't worked in 19 months or who have been hanging on for this day. You know, friends of mine work in the industry, so I suppose I have it from that point of view. The idea that people have been hanging on, waiting, being told this is going to happen. They're also hearing too that the PUP is trying to be phased out, that eventually they won't maybe have the financial support, and they're worried about their careers. So I think that the government in one sense listens to public opinion and has to decide what it will do about it, or listens to sectoral opinion and decides what to do about it. And it decided in this way to make a decision that maybe on the face of it, you might think, well, maybe that might not be great, but it has its reasons.
Knowing in your friends then who are in that sector and people who are in the arts and performing arts sectors, this idea of ticketing for nightclubs, because it even still is vague. And again, this is another reason why we need the regulations, because there's some talk that the tickets can't be bought on the door or can't be bought in advance. They'd have to be bought the night before you're going out, which seems like, when there is such a grey area between what is a nightclub and what is a late bar and what is a theatre, and pubs that have theatre licences, which basically makes them become nightclubs, it all seems like a really, really, like a real void of policy and certainty to be working into when these are supposed to apply tomorrow night, apparently.
It's really naughty in terms of the, like you're talking about there, the licensing and the different types of licenses places could have, and the, like, if you're a bar and you have a live gig, can you have people standing up, or if you can't, or if you have a wedding and you have a band, does that qualify for it? So it's all of these ins and outs is very complicated. And, you know, you would have at one point you'd musician Dahi who was saying, well, you know, I play electronic music and then I, you know, maybe grab the fiddle halfway through my set, does that mean it qualifies for DJing and then I become a live band? But I think that, like, the second part of your question there, I just forgot what you were doing.
As have I, because I've been looking at some of the texts and tweets that are coming in, none of which are terribly hospitable. Well, sorry, about the whether you can, how it's supposed to work.
Sorry, the ticketing.
Could be ticketing maybe 24 hours in advance, or that not on, like, your phone on
that
the
that doesn't seem
off.
Very realistic, right? And I mean, also the very nature of nightclubs is that the place you kind of fall into after you've left a club, right? Left a pub, you kind of decide on a whim where you're going to go. People don't generally go
because you haven't had enough drink.
Yeah, well,
it's
you just want to dance, and you want to kind of, the night becomes something else when you go into a nightclub, you know? And so I think if you're the owner of a nightclub, or you're a promoter, you're like, are people really going to be buying a ticket the night before? Mm. But maybe we've all gotten used to all of these new things that we have to do. So maybe people who really want to go out, like, I wouldn't mind buying a ticket if I was going to go into a nightclub. Maybe people will do it. You
massive
know?
Ramifications for those who are in possession of gold cards for a certain famed Dublin hostelry as well, because it's not quite the golden ticket that it used to be. Fergus, I just see that Shane Ross is making
a gold card for a nightclub.
There's a gold card for a certain nightclub,
we
which has been name checked. Some of the other places that it doesn't need the free advertising now. Shane Ross is making the argument, by the way, in the page 29 of the Sunday Independent, that people don't go clubbing to obey the rules; they go to get blotto. Which maybe he's from on a different political spectrum to you, Fergus, but he might have a similar advantage when it comes to modern day nightclub behaviour, perhaps. Fergus, the first Red Sea poll published by the Business Post since the budget, and ordinarily you would think if a budget is a popular one that it would do well for the government parties, and yet combined, Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and the Green Party losing 5 points, while Sinn Féin is now 8 points ahead of the most popular government party. What does that tell you about how the budget's gone down?
Well, if you asked me to tell you today the three main features of the budget, I couldn't do it. And I would regard myself as somebody who kind of keeps a close eye
that's
on
the budget
kind of
that
stuff.
Was 12 days ago.
Fortnite's
a long time in politics.
It was one of the most immediately forgettable budgets, I think, in part because every single bit of it was splashed all over the papers and the media in
advance. Ethan Moore commented that it was better flagged than East Belfast in mid-July.
There you go. I mean, my sense of it is that it tried to do something for everyone in the audience and spread everything very thin. I've argued year after year after year that someday a government minister is going to decide, or Minister of Finance is going to decide, I'm going to make a big difference in one area and everything else is just going to have to wait another year. I mean, this was an opportunity, I would have thought, for example, to, you know, have a childcare budget or an education budget.
And you don't want to always look through things electorally speaking, but when you're only in the second year, what's likely to be a 5-year programme, is it not really the time to start doing that? Because it might be the budget before the election where everyone goes, well, I want my token tax cut. Yeah. But year 2 out of 5 is maybe the 1 year when you can ring fence money and keep it aside and do something meaningful with it.
If you try to look back, take a kind of historical perspective of it, the budgets that tend to be remembered are the ones that made a complete fiasco. Every other
children's
budget we've had.
Decentralisation.
Decentralisation, children's shoes, those kind of things. The only budget that I think kind of goes down in history as a kind of legendary sort of budget was Charlie Hoy's 66 budget when most of the people around here weren't even alive, when he introduced free travel for old age pensioners and the artist's exemption, which had, you know, both lasted ever since. And I still meet old people who say, ah, Charlie, what say what you like about him.
But he gave us the free travel pass.
He gave us the free travel.
But then, why is it then that other stuff which might be considered comparable in the modern day, like successive ministers for health giving free GP care to under sixes and under eights, and as it's been progressively rolled out over time, they don't seem to get that kind of same societal kudos. But when you could argue that it's of equal impact.
Equal, if not bigger. And part of the reason is because they're lumped in with everything else. They're not properly promoted, flagged and so on.
And so the budgets are so well flagged that in fact they're allowing the good news be diluted.
We're used now to enormous amounts of money. Do you know, Gavin, and I think you could probably correct me, but I'm fairly sure you couldn't.
I wouldn't dare.
Charlie, the budget surplus that Charlie Haughey had when he went into that budget was £18 million. Not billion, not 180 million, £18 million. The cost of introducing the free travel that year was in the hundreds of thousands. And yet it was artful, it was well designed, it was his moment. Don O'Malley subsequently announced free second level education in a way that was completely uncosted.
Without having costed it or consulted anyone else first.
No, there were no implications, nothing was worked out, but it was never forgotten. I mean, he became a legend as a consequence of doing it. Now you can announce a £3 billion scheme and everyone says, what's the next thing?
Like the capital spend for the Department of Housing next year is €6 billion and everyone's complaining that the budget doesn't do enough because there were no new measures for renters. Before we move on, because we do have to finish up in a couple of minutes, Aoife, there's one significant story on the front of the Sunday Independent, which is, you know, it's the one bit that isn't about COVID, about this idea that it's now gotten so high as to be on the agenda of cabinet ministers that there could be domestic blackouts before the end of the year.
Yeah, it's actually so strange, isn't it? I think after everything the last couple of years, we really didn't think that maybe we weren't paying attention at this stage where we're talking about potential blackouts over the winter time. Now, that being said, all of the messaging from government is that they're going to do their damnedest to make sure that doesn't happen, but that doesn't mean that we are not going to be worried. So there's going to be a confidential briefing note, or there is a confidential briefing note for the Cabinet Committee on Climate Change, and the ministers were told in it that energy suppliers could be forced to introduce emergency measures to cope with the high demand for electricity during the kind of colder winter months, and that there's worst case scenario with contingency plans, and under them businesses will be given as little as an hour's notice to reduce their electricity use or to switch to generators.
Yeah. Well, this is it. In circumstances where customers can replace their entire electricity use with generators, which I should say, is it the case maybe in a lot of households where people have disabilities and where there might be particularly sensitive medical equipment that can't go without a backup power supply? So in houses like that, they could be cut off by Airgrid if they don't reduce their energy within an hour of being contacted.
Which is such a the reality of that for people is a hugely disruptive thing. And also, I think that people are looking at this messaging and they're saying that one part of it says every measure will be taken to avoid this happening. But the other thing says, well, this could happen. So people are like, well, do I presume that I'll be okay? Or do I really panic and worry now? Because nobody wants to be in the situation where they're without power. And then, you know, it's kind of this, I think for a lot of maybe the younger kind of generations, it's this thing that harks back to generations ago where we think, well, we're past that. Mm. You know, we don't have to worry about this. But we do have to worry
about this. We don't think about that.
This is actually a very real worry for people.
In 30 seconds, Fergus, Aoife's touched on a really important point there, which is that the state is saying that we'll do everything to stop this happening and yet can't confirm that it won't happen, which means in a curious and very depressing way, the state seems powerless to stop us being powerless.
and I think that is the fact. I think this is going to be one of those supply and demand issues this winter. We do not have enough electricity. We're not generating enough. We have, I think it's 2 stations that are temporarily out of commission at the moment. And I think it's inevitable that we're going to have blackouts. In fact, if I was a conspiracy theorist, I would say they're already happening. I experienced one that went on for 3 hours in Wicklow recently. There was one in Glasdoole the other night, went on for about an hour. Now, when you get on, they're both accidental outages, it says. But the conspiracy theorist in me says they're getting us ready, they're getting us ready.
On that sunny uplands note, let's draw a line under it all there. Aoife Barry, Assistant News Editor of The Journal, thank you. And also Fergus Findlay, columnist with the Irish Examiner and a member of the board of the HSE.
On the record, on Newstalk.
Brought to you by PwC. A community of solvers coming together in unexpected ways. It all adds up to the new equation.